Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dave Zanata. He's a malacologist, or one who studies mollusks. He's also a molecular ecologist and a conservation geneticist. Today, we talk about mollusks. So first, thank you for your work. And second, thank you for being on the program. And third, so can you tell people about mollusks? And they might not even know what they are. And then what is happening to them?
Okay. Well, thank you for having me on the show. And it's a real pleasure to get to relay some of my knowledge about perhaps a less than charismatic group of organisms like mollusks. They're extremely important. My research is mostly on the freshwater variety, but mollusks are an ancient group of invertebrate animals. They've been on the earth for the last 600 million years or so, invaded fresh waters many times from marine environments, and then gone on to invade the land in several instances long before vertebrate animals did. So they've been around a very, very long time, hundreds of millions of years, in fresh waters for probably several hundred million years as well. The freshwater bivalves that I work on have a fossil record that goes back probably 250 million years. And they have done very well for themselves across the globe, living in their shells, either a single spiraled shell like a snail, or in a pair of shells like a bivalve or a clam or a mussel, or without a shell at all like a slug or an octopus. These are all members of the phylum Mollusca. So my research is, again, primarily freshwater. I'm interested mostly in freshwater bivalves from the family that's called the Unionidae. These are fairly diverse group of bivalves, about 600 to 800 species, depending on the taxonomic expert that you talk to. Again, very long fossil record and of 250 million years, and they are about 300 species in North America, primarily centered in and around the Mississippi River drainage of North America. Southeastern United States has probably the world's highest diversity of freshwater mussels, and they've faced a lot of challenges in the last couple hundred of years in terms of pollution, degradation of habitats, construction of dams, and general habitat degradation from a variety of sources, industrial pollution, agricultural pollution, recently in the form of invasive mollusks like zebra mussels and quagga mussels that have fouled their shells, and the kind of cast of nasty characters that that have followed the mussels are largely responsible, are largely due to human impacts. So my research is on freshwater bivalves. I'm interested in how they've evolved, how we can work to conserve them, trying to figure out their ecology, their life histories, which is fascinating, and all sorts of things about freshwater mollusks.
So before we get to the threats and the disaster around this, can we talk just briefly? I know something that always struck me when I was a child was the notion of how clams, for example, got to upper reaches of streams, and you talked about them invading. And can you talk about just, you know, help people to fall in love with them as I did when I learned about this? How do they make their way upstream? I mean, I can't imagine a clam. So how does that work for different species?
Well, I mentioned that there have been, for mollusks, there have been a variety of different invasions into fresh water from marine environments, and this happened many times over the last few hundred million years. For the freshwater mussels that I work on, they are actually parasites on fishes during their early life history. So as a larva, which we call a glochidium, they actually attach onto the gills of a fish, and they hitch a ride. They can travel, for example, with a salmon or a sturgeon or some of these highly vagile or migratory fishes hundreds of kilometers upstream, as long as there are no barriers in the way, of course. so they've evolved this parasitic lifestyle to be able to rapidly move upstream and against a current, compared to some of their marine cousins like blue mussels or something that you might find in a restaurant. These use a free-floating veliger larva that float around in currents and are controlled by water currents. And this is really good in an ocean environment, but would be something that would be not very preferential in a freshwater environment where you're constantly battling against a current in a river.
Yeah, I remember reading about that when I was maybe 15 or something, and just, as so often happens, being so blown away by how, I hate to use the word works, but how the natural world works in terms of creative solutions to problems. You know, if the problem is how do you get upstream, I mean, that's a pretty creative solution. You know, just hitchhike a ride on a fish.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating example of a very strong natural selection. And there are a variety of different ways, because this parasitic relationship and being able to move upstream and disperse into new habitats is so critical for freshwater mussels, that they've evolved all sorts of fascinating strategies to get their larvae onto the fish. Some use this just a broadcast release of larvae in kind of mass numbers. Others have evolved all sorts of different ways to trick fish into getting them close enough to get the larvae onto the fins or the gills of the fish. Some have actually evolved various different ways of mimicking prey items that the fish think are ways for them to think food for them to eat, get them close enough, the fish strikes at a lure of some kind and out spew the larval mussels right into the face of the fish, and they become parasitized that way. We do understand that there isn't a real negative impact on the fish. Natural infestations by freshwater mussels are usually very small. These are microscopic, like 100 to 300 microns across. So just a few tiny parasitic larvae of a mussel aren't going to really do a lot of damage to a fish.
Kind of like a mite on your eyebrows or something.
Right. A very, very minor infection.
So I guess there's one more direction I want to go before we actually talk about the threat, which is another thing we hear about a lot is the capacity is tell me about some of the roles, and I don't care from a human perspective. I'm caring from the perspective of the natural community. Tell me about some of the roles that mollusks play in a natural community. I don't like to use the word ecosystem because it's too mechanistic. You can use it if you want. It's just when I use the word natural community, you can use the word ecosystem if you want. So what are some of the roles they play? Like I've heard about water purification. So can you talk about that and talk about other things they do that are benefits to the natural community?
Well, depending on the different group of mollusks that you're interested in, but they're all mollusks are in freshwater systems, at least, are generally very important in nutrient cycling and kind of renewing resources in aquatic environments. So freshwater bivalves are filter feeders, and they're important in kind of filtering out materials from the water itself. Most bivalves, at least in native North American bivalves, are important for kind of what we call bioturbation. They kind of stir up the sediments a little bit. They kind of cruise around through the sand and the mud and the silts and stuff that are at the bottoms of streams and lakes, and they kind of turn that over a little bit. Freshwater gastropods, which are also highly diverse in North America, are very important grazers in algal communities. So they basically scrape algae off of rocks and help to cycle nutrients that way as well. And then they're throughout the systems, they're important in the food web, of course. Snails are important to prey for lots of fishes. Freshwater bivalves. As adults, not so perhaps important as a prey item. There are mammals that eat them, things like mink, raccoon, muskrat will eat them, and even some benthic fishes will eat them, bottom-dwelling fishes. But They're more in the kind of food web as juveniles when they're smaller. Once they get large, and some of the freshwater bivalves that I work on can get to 3, 4, 6 inches, up to 6 inches, 8 inches long. So it can get quite large.
And I know that I live in the rainforest, the redwood rainforest of far northern California.
Yep.
And I know that banana slugs are an important what was the word you used? Was it nutrient turnover? They're very important for breaking down. I mean, basically, they eat poop, you know,
yep.
And they eat tree leaves, and they're basically garbage collectors and recyclers.
And that would be a good description for a freshwater mussel in a stream system as well.
So do you mean that a lot of them, like, do they eat fish poop?
Yeah, I mean, living in a river system or a lake or any kind of aquatic system, a lot of that gets dissolved down, and we call that dissolved organic carbon. And a lot of that there are bacteria that are feeding on that. We all include all of those dissolved materials in the water in kind of that dissolved organic carbon that they're feeding on. And they'll feed heavily on that. They'll feed on algaes. They'll feed on anything that's small enough to be captured by their gills, which are kind of their filtering apparatus that they have.
So now let's talk about the threats. There have been, would you use the word catastrophic to describe the last 200 years on mollusks in North America? Or if not, then what word would you use?
Catastrophic would be a reasonable word to use. The last 150 years have been very hard on our freshwater resources in general. Water quality has suffered, habitat has suffered because of agriculture, urban and industrial pollution. Up until probably the 1970s, before the Clean Water Act was instituted, things were pretty bleak out there. And then dam construction, although probably turned the country around during the Great Depression, those dams by and large remain. And those were barriers to the movement of fish, which are critical for the life cycle of freshwater mussels and preventing them from moving upstream, and also changed the habitats from free-running river systems to basically small kind of gravel and shoals and stuff that were excellent mussel habitat into impounded sections, which are turn them into lakes, which some mussels might be adapted for, but the highest diversity of freshwater mussels, especially in the southeastern United States, was adapted for living in free-running large river systems. And those rivers became massively altered in the last century, in the 20th century, and many species went extinct. The scientific literature says somewhere around, we quote it in every scientific paper that we publish, says 70% of all freshwater mussels are at risk of extinction or at imminent risk of extinction. And that's that number, 70% of all species, of 300 species, that means that we're on the brink of losing. I mean, that's like kind of end of the dinosaurs kind of level of extinction rate. That's catastrophic.
I want to say that's terrible, but words don't really suffice. We know that dams are a threat for the reasons you've given, and can you talk about some of the other threats? And leave off exotic invasives for now. We'll deal with that in a minute. So
sure.
Talk about some of the other threats.
Okay, so the pollution that I've talked about, we built dams to power. I mean, largely for at first it was to build mills, and they built dams on areas of rivers where there was fast moving water, which was largely great habitat for mussels. And those mill dams, those were fine. There wasn't necessarily a whole lot of issue with pollution associated initially with those mills, but then they made hydroelectric power from those mills, which powered more and more powerful factories, which then produced chemicals, which produced all sorts of nasty industrial pollutants that were entered the waters. And freshwater mussels are, the word that we like to use, are kind of considered canaries in the coal mine. And literally, a lot of those areas in the Appalachian Mountains in the southeastern United States are areas that are areas that are heavily mined for coal, and you have lots of coal plants and construction of refineries and steel mills along those areas. They were heavily used for industrial activities, and mussels are highly intolerant of those kind of chronic effects of those industrial type pollutants. And then we have largely changed the Midwestern United States, which was a vast tall grass prairie and forested lands, removed those forests, changed that agriculture, that prairie landscape into an agricultural landscape for corn primarily, soybean and so on. That changes of the land use has really changed, added to agricultural pollution. So adding pesticides and adding fertilizers into that landscape have really changed the system. And then also allowing for huge amounts of siltation and fine particulate into those waters has changed that landscape as well, and changed the aquatic systems that were present 100 years ago from fairly clear, clean running systems to much more silty systems. And the organisms that were there either had to adapt, or perhaps were used to living in those types of systems, or they were going to disappear. And for many of the mussels that don't move very easily, except with the use of a host fish, they did disappear. So you've got the kind of triple whammy effect, or double whammy to start off with. You've got the dams, you've got the pollutants, and then you have larger and larger urban centers that have, up until fairly recently, didn't have very good water treatment facilities. Those added to additional effects on the aquatic landscape. So dams and all the pollutants involved have really done a lot of damage. It's something that you can kind of differentiate between the agricultural pollution and the industrial pollution. Industrial pollution tends to be short-term, massive impact, and results in, it means spills and so on, result in destruction of the aquatic environment. The agricultural effects are a lot more long-term, chronic, can perhaps, with additional impacts of other things like dams, or when we get to them, invasive species, that can lead to a slow erosion of the biodiversity, loss of species.
So there's a question I should have asked you a minute ago before we go to the invasives or the exotics. A question I should have asked is, you know, there are accounts of like flocks of passenger pigeons that were so large they darkened the sky for days at a time, and of herds of bison that are so large that you can sit there and it'd be 4 days while one herd runs by. And, you know, there's accounts we've heard of a lot of those. And the same with fish, you know, that runs of salmon that literally go on for days, and you can hear them for miles before you see them. And I actually don't know the answer to this at all. Are there accounts, like, there? When I go to the ocean here, I live 3 miles from the Pacific Ocean, and I never walk on the rocks that are in the intertidal zone, because even still, they are usually, it's impossible to walk on them without crushing little snails. Mm-hmm. And I don't particularly want to crush them for no reason. And so do you know of accounts of freshwater mollusk fecundity? Do we have baseline accounts of what they were like before this culture started hammering them? Just anecdotal accounts.
We do have pretty good accounts. And that's the other thing about freshwater mussels, at least. That there is a commercial value to them as well. They produce pearls. All mollusks have at least the potential to produce pearls, but freshwater mussels are actually one of the largest pearl producers. And in the late 1800s, early 20th century, there was an actual pearl rush on the Mississippi River and some of the large tributaries. And the accounts there were, hundreds of millions of mussels were taken from the rivers. And when one mussel bed, which is what you would call an aggregation of mussels in a river, was depleted, they would go on to the next mussel bed and basically harvest them until they were all gone. And the way they did this was they took small boats called John boats, and then they would pull a what's called a brail behind them and pull up the mussels literally with these little hooks on the bottom. The mussel would sense, get this hook between their valves and clam up quite literally and the fishermen would pull the mussel out of the water. So hundreds of millions of mussels were removed, and the densities were astronomical. Now, by and large, the mussels could recover naturally, but for the most part, there are still large portions of the large rivers in eastern North America that have large numbers of mussels in them. But the combined effects of this overfishing with the lack of ability of fish to get back into these areas because of dams, to the issues of pollution, have combined their effects that many species were lost and many more have failed so far to recover to kind of that pre-1800s level.
And so let's talk about exotics now. You mentioned, I believe, zebra and quagga mussels.
Yes.
How did that happen? What do they do? What's the problem?
So zebra and quagga mussels are also freshwater bivalves. They are native to the Black and Caspian Sea regions of Eastern Europe. They first arrived in North America on a transoceanic freighter into the Great Lakes, probably in the mid to late 1980s. There are a couple accounts that they probably arrived in about 1986 or 87. They were discovered on wellheads in western Lake Erie and in some, actually a science student from the University of Windsor in Ontario, Canada, found some in just where the Lake St. Clair meets the Detroit River in Ontario. And that was in 1988. So 1987, 88, they were first discovered, and they rapidly spread through all of the Great Lakes within a few years, and not just spread, but achieved massive densities of 750,000 per square meter, smothering basically everything along the lake bottoms in the Great Lakes, especially in shallow and coastal areas of the Great Lakes. So these were zebra mussels. In 1992, quagga mussel arrived, and the quagga mussel invaded basically everywhere that the zebra mussel didn't, so in the deeper portions of the lake, and those achieved massive densities and have gone on to have extraordinary changes in the Great Lakes. Now, since the initial invasion in the late 80s and early 90s of the Great Lakes, they've spread to all sorts of inland lakes. They've spread into the Mississippi River drainage. And quagga mussels have since arrived into the Colorado River drainage. They've achieved massive densities in Lake Mead and Lake Powell in California and Nevada and Arizona, basically up into throughout the Colorado River system, anywhere there's a large impoundment. So the life history of a zebra and a quagga mussel are pretty different from the mussels native to North America. They're not parasites on fish. They have a free floating, what we call a veliger larva, that's moved around by currents, and they don't burrow into the substrate of a river or a lake. They cling onto rocks with these little threads that we call Bissell threads, and they can form very dense aggregations of hundreds of thousands per square meter, which is they're quite a bit smaller. A large adult zebra or quagga mussel is about the size of your thumbnail.
And so, why, from the perspective of someone who cares about mussels, mollusks, and who cares about the health of the Great Lakes or the Colorado River, why do we care?
So the zebra mussels, and maybe a little less so the quagga mussel, are very, very good filters, even more efficient filterer than the native mussels in North America. They also seem to preferentially settle on native mussel shell. And if you think about the way that the zebra mussel and quagga mussels have this veliger larva, they float around in the water and they'll settle onto a hard surface like a native mussel shell. And they basically that veliger larva is being sucked towards the native mussel shell because they're constantly filtering small particles out of the water. And it actually is somewhat advantageous to settle on something that's actively bringing water towards it as well, because the native mussels are actively pumping water through their bodies too. So it's like getting a free lunch out of the deal as well. So the zebra mussels and quagga mussels aggregate and onto the native mussel shell, can form huge numbers, tens to hundreds to thousands of zebra mussels or quagga mussels onto a native mussel shell. And they smother it. They starve it to death is what was actually kind of the modus operandi of a quagga mussel or zebra mussel on a native mussel. So they smother it. They prevent it from being able to feed properly. They also prevent it from being able to move properly. The weight of the zebra or quagga mussels on top of the native mussel can far exceed the actual weight of the native mussel and cause them to tip over, and they won't be able to right themselves and won't be able to feed properly. Can't reproduce properly. Remember, I talked about some of the native mussels using lures and stuff like that. They can't expose that lure for a fish to see, so they're not going to be able to reproduce. And the zebra mussels can actually filter the water very efficiently, so sperm and stuff like that that the native mussels are releasing into the water to reproduce with the females out there, they won't be able to do that properly either. So they literally smother the native mussels to death. Something that is at least a little bit encouraging is that it's only been about 25 years since zebra mussels and quagga mussels entered North America. And we haven't seen an extinction caused by a zebra mussel or quagga mussel in North America. We have seen near extirpations in parts of the Great Lakes, but they are doing okay in coastal areas. The native mussels are doing okay in some coastal areas and in tributary streams. The zebra mussels and quagga mussels don't do very well in free-flowing systems. And the other encouraging thing is in 200 years that Western Europe has been invaded by zebra mussels and quagga mussels, none of the native species in Europe have gone extinct in 200 years. So it might be that coexistence is possible in the long term.
And who eats zebra mussels? Is there any chance of the community, you know, ridding themselves of it or at least reducing their numbers?
I think there's some evidence that there is some natural control, as we see with a lot of kind of invasions of different organisms, that you have this initial pulse where you have this huge numbers initially, and then kind of some natural regulations. And what's happened in the Great Lakes is that a lot of species, especially diving ducks, some mollusks feeding fishes like freshwater drum and others as well, actually feed quite voraciously on the zebra mussels. On the other hand, though, there's been huge change in the Great Lakes. In Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, the bottom of the food chain is basically collapsed, and there aren't any of the invertebrates that were formerly present there, except for the zebra mussels and quagga mussels. So it's had gone through extraordinary change because of these invasive mollusks.
I recently interviewed someone about the effects of plastics on the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And how about do plastics, and especially like the microplastics, when they break down, physically break down to very tiny, do they harm mollusks as well?
I don't think we know much about that. That would be an area of research that we'd have to explore further. Honestly, I don't know. I think we're still figuring out how bad the kind of microbead issue is. And I mean, obviously, it's a big issue for water quality. For the mollusks, it sounds like, I mean, that would be something that would be right about this particle size that they'd be feeding on. So it could be a problem, but I don't have a clue if we have to do some science to see if it is a problem for them.
So another person I interviewed recently had to do with chytrid and amphibians in general. And one of the things we were talking about was the susceptibility of amphibians versus reptiles. How amphibians are more susceptible to, for example, pesticides than are reptiles because of they have the permeable skin. And is it the case that mollusks are especially sensitive to, say, endocrine disruptors, neurotoxins, whatever, heavy metals, whatever it is that ends up in the water?
Heavy metals, definitely. A lot of studies on heavy metals in terms of freshwater mollusks. Some of the things that are very important for freshwater mollusks are actually ammonia is extremely toxic for freshwater mollusks. And it's especially toxic for the larval stage of the mollusk, so the glaucidium and the juvenile stage, so the very small kind of just after they parasitize the fish. And the US EPA has actually changed their kind of minimum level of or yeah minimum level of ammonia allowed in water systems based on freshwater mussel research, because mussels are the most sensitive organisms to that.
And when you say ammonia, do you mean are you talking about like from pee, or are you talking about like from the ammonia compounds in fertilizer, or both?
Fertilizers.
And I don't know if people know this, but ammonia is a major compound in a lot, or a major component of a lot of fertilizers.
Correct.
One of my environmentalist friends, one of the things he likes to say is, well, how's it go? If we keep going the direction we're going to get to where we're going. And I mean, basically, so barring some sort of significant change in land use, in way of life, in everything, what do you foresee for North American freshwater mollusks?
I haven't really gotten to it, but there ha in the last 25 years or so, there has been a real awakening that there that this I that the declines were catastrophic, and that there has been real headway made in terms of protecting these important resources and important kind of indicator organisms for overall health of aquatic environments. And a lot of money has been put into research, and a lot of money has been put into restoration. One of our issues is that just we didn't know a lot about the biology of a lot of these poorly known organisms. So we had to first figure out life histories for them, figure out what the threats were, and then once we knew the threats, kind of working on reversing those threats. One of the nice things is that with water quality improving through the 1970s and 80s, that a lot of the major industrial pollutants out there are no longer too much of a threat. And as long as people are working to mitigate some of the agricultural threats with improved kind of riparian zones, basically planting trees and preventing agricultural wastewater from reaching the streams as quite as easily as what they had, that those streams have a good way of kind of restoring themselves. As long as there are no barriers like dams in the way, then the systems can restore themselves. The thing is, though, that there are dams in the way, and that the mollusks that were might be still hanging on in small pockets here and there, are highly fragmented from each other. So a lot of what's gone on are kind of artificial restoration projects. So actually bringing the mollusks in captivity, breeding them, and letting them grow to a size that they'll be able to survive back out in nature, and then bringing them back out into streams that are relatively healthy. As long as the fish are present, the mollusks are going to do fairly well, and they're no longer threats in the area. So a lot of very good restoration science has been done on mollusks, and I think that there's hope for a lot of species, and that we're going to be able to reverse some of the declines that we're trying hard to understand.
So it sounds like there are as well as being fragile on one level, they're fairly, I mean, it sounds like a contradiction, but as well as being fragile or sensitive on one level, it sounds like they're fairly resilient on another.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, fragile perhaps in the larval stage. Once you get past that, the kind of the fragility of being a juvenile or a larval mussel, if you can get them to adulthood, they are going to be able to hang on fairly well. You have to make sure that they can get past that initial stage, that kind of critical kind of adolescence, so to speak, and get them into adulthood, and then they'll be able to reproduce fairly well on their own.
So can you give listeners a specific success story of restoration?
Well, specific success story. I guess there has been a lot of really good work in the Upper Tennessee rivers, in kind of Virginia and Tennessee in the U.S. A lot of work that's been spearheaded by Virginia Tech University, the kind of father of freshwater mussel biology and conservation, was Dr. Richard Neves at Virginia Tech, and he's his work and people that have continued his work since have gone on to do amazing things and making sure that some of the kind of that was the center of biodiversity in the Tennessee River, and some of the few remaining pockets of some of the most rare species in all of North America are still there, largely because of his kind of pioneering work from in the 1970s, 1980s, and early 1990s.
You know, restoration and re-inhabitation, and it doesn't really matter whether it's like timber wolves who, you know, re-inhabit on their own, or whether it's, you know, black-footed ferret where they have to do an intensive program, or California condor. Those stories always make me, I mean, things are looking pretty bad all around. And whenever I hear any of those re-inhabitation stories, it always, that's one of the few places I find solace and optimism.
Yep. It's actually a real honor to be able to go to these places where native species have been restored or conserved, and to see what the kind of an intact faunal community or organismal community looks like. And being in those kind of places, I think, is really special. And we have those places still in, I mean, they might not be as pervasive as what they were 200 years ago. I would love to have seen a free-flowing Ohio River or Mississippi River 200 years ago, but and seen the mussel diversity and the abundance of them there. But there are still places where you can still go and see that. It might not be everywhere, but we still be able to see something.
And that's one of the things that just kills me about this whole culture is the general lack of recognition that a forest or a river or a lake needs all of its members. And even if we don't understand the, quote, role, end quote, that species plays in the community – that, I mean, who could guess just off the top of their head that you know, the importance of banana slugs for the forest or whatever. It's just it stuns me how often we forget that, and then you see this fully functioning community, and it is a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It just being able to see an intact community, I think, is something that I mean, it changed me when I was doing my PhD work and got to visit the Clinch River, which is a tributary of the in the Upper Tennessee River system, and seeing my colleague and I who were out sampling that day. It was a cold October day. We were in our wetsuits snorkeling through the river. I think we saw something like 30 mussel species in a couple hours of searching, and there's almost nowhere else on Earth that you can see something like that. And being, you're seeing not just the mussels, but the snails that are there, the fishes that are there. You get to see the grandeur of biodiversity when things are at work.
So I guess I have three questions left. The first question is, we have just a few minutes left. The first question is, so what would you want for listeners of this interview to take away that they know in their heart? Like one thing, what is it that you want them to know?
I think that conservation of biodiversity isn't just about the furry things, the feathery things, but it's also about organisms that might be somewhat considered, at least on the surface, somewhat less charismatic. And that some of those kind of role players in the environment that don't get maybe the media attention, which I appreciate you're giving this kind of media attention. I think it's really important to think beyond just perhaps what the media thinks. Oh, these are charismatic. We need to preserve these things. We need to preserve biodiversity in general and the whole, because the systems don't work without all of the role players present.
You know, I think about this like a body. You know, it's like the the pancreas. Who thinks about the pancreas? But it's actually kind of important. Or the liver, you know. It's like the ones who don't get a lot of press, but they still, you know, I wouldn't really want to live without capillaries.
Right.
So my next question is, what if somebody listens to this, what do you want them to do to help mollusks, both in like a grand scale, and also if what can they do, like if they have a little bit of land? Like I talked to the Kindred person, and she was saying that you know, they don't use pesticides on their lawns. You know, that's a very small thing, and I don't know how much you know about my work, but my work is all about really the grander. I don't think individual choice does not make social change. Right. Nonetheless, what do you want them to do on a large scale, and what do you want them to do on a small scale?
Well, on a small scale, if you are a landowner, think about where your water goes, where your wastewater goes. If you live in an urban area, I mean, it's going into a sewer somewhere, but it has to go somewhere else. Think about what you're putting down that sewer. If you're a landowner, perhaps in a rural area, you are connected to a river. Even if you might not live right on a body of water, that you are somewhere in that watershed, and where your water will ultimately go to somewhere where mollusks do live. It's really important to think of what fertilizers you're putting on it, what pesticides you might be putting on it. And if you do live right on a river, you can think about building up more kind of buffer between whatever land use that you're having and the aquatic system. So planting trees in a riparian strip, or some kind of vegetation in a kind of a naturalized situation. It just baffles me that people want to build and kind of construct things right up to the water's edge all the time. It doesn't make any sense. And for safety reasons, but also for protecting biodiversity. On a larger scale, I think we have to talk to our politicians, advocate for biodiversity, and advocate for that biodiversity is kind of protected in the whole, not just for things that perhaps get charismatic, kind of big picture, kind of this is something that's the flavor of the week for someone, but rather biodiversity in a whole, not just individual species, so whole system biodiversity.
Okay, my last question is, if they were, if they, whoever they is, were, if you were suddenly made to be the king of all things mollusk in North America. You can do whatever you want. What would you do?
Well, if funding's always an issue.
Yeah.
So I have unlimited funding.
Yeah. So the culture has a fit of sanity and takes money from the military and gives it to mollusks.
Right. Right. Just
you have as much money as you can use.
Tiny fraction. I would love to see a real strong research program into understanding their fascinating biodiversity, understanding basic biology of some of these organisms that we're just starting to scratch the surface on. And then I would want to see really strong restoration programs so that we'd be able to restore both either through augmenting populations that already exist or restoring areas where they could exist. And restoring is going to require probably several steps. And that would mean first making sure that threats are gone or mitigated. And then we would have to probably do artificial propagation so that we could restore large areas of habitat so that we could, and it wouldn't just be necessarily the critically endangered species, but it would be the whole communities that would have to be restored to what they were 100 years ago with 30, 40 mollusk species in a system rather than just sometimes it's been degraded down to 70%.
I was wrong. I do have one more question. Which is that I know that when dams have been removed, that people have been stunned at how quickly the migratory, whether it's you know ocean going or whether just lake going, how quickly the migratory fish move back up, literally within weeks. And so, if with dam removal, can we presume that? Because the fish would be moving up, that the mollusks would probably be moving up on the fish's gills as quickly?
We do have to be careful with dam removal, make sure it's done not only safely for people downstream, but also for the aquatic organisms around. With certain types of dams, it's actually starting to be shown that those areas immediately downstream, especially like low head dams and top draw dams and so on, are actually pretty good habitat for some of the mussels. Now, obviously, immediately upstream, you might have all sorts of siltation and impoundment issues. But as long as it's done safely and that you're not harming anything that's currently there, there's no reason that if there's no more barrier for fish access, that the mussels are going to be starting to move back into those areas. And the aquatic system will fix itself once the barrier is no longer in place.
Well, thank you so much for everything you've said, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dave Zanotta. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.